All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're doing a deep dive into a couple of tax court cases, both involving a taxpayer named Baker.
Sounds intriguing. Always up for some legal deep dives, especially when it comes to taxes.
So these cases really get to the core of some really common areas where people end up having disputes with the IRS.
Like what? Give us a taste.
Like how certain types of income end up getting classified and, you know, those dependency exemptions, who gets to claim them. Always a big deal, right?
Oh, absolutely. Dependency exemptions can make a huge difference come tax time, and the IRS rules around them can get pretty complicated.
So we dug through these two Baker cases, looked at the arguments, the evidence, the whole nine yards, so we can break down what went wrong for these taxpayers and, more importantly, what folks out there can learn from these situations.
Especially for anyone dealing with business income or trying to navigate the sometimes, well, let's just say, interesting world of family tax benefits.
Okay, so first up, we've got Baker v. Commissioner.
All right, lay it on me. Who's this Baker and what they do?
So this is about Warren Baker. He was an independent contractor for State Farm Insurance for a very long time. 34 years, actually.
Wow, that's a long time to be with one company, especially as an independent contractor. Most folks I know hop around a lot more these days.
Yeah, he worked with them from 1963 to 1997. And when he retired, State Farm paid him what they called a termination payment of $38,622.
And I'm guessing that nice little chunk of change is where the trouble with the IRS started.
You got it. The main issue is how to classify that termination payment for tax purposes.
Okay, so classic tax problem. Is it this kind of income or that kind of income? What did Baker say it was?
Baker's argument was that this money was basically a capital gain from the sale of goodwill, you know, the reputation and relationships he built up over all those years working with State Farm.
Interesting. So he's essentially arguing that his personal brand, his network, his reputation within State Farm system, all of that had value. And when he retired, he was essentially selling that intangible asset.
Exactly. But of course, the IRS had other ideas. They were like, nope, that's just ordinary income. Pay up.
The classic IRS move. So the tax court had to step in and decide who was right.
And they sided with the IRS.
No surprise there. But I'm curious, what was the reasoning behind their decision?
So here's where things get a little technical, but it's important because it highlights how critical contracts are in these situations.
Contracts are always key. You gotta dot your I's and cross your T's, especially when it comes to taxes.
The court looked closely at Baker's contract with State Farm, and it clearly stated that he, as an independent contractor, did not own things like customer lists or any other kind of intangible business assets.
So the court's saying, hold on. If you don't own these assets, you can't very well sell them, can you?
Right. And if you can't sell them, you can't claim a capital gain on a sale that didn't happen.
Makes perfect sense. You can't sell what you don't own.
So basically, the court said that the things that would typically make up goodwill in a situation like this, things like customer relationships and those lists we talked about, they actually all belonged to State Farm according to the contract.
So there was no sale of a capital asset by Baker for the court to even consider.
Exactly. But there's another interesting twist in this case. Part of that $38,622 tour payment was actually tied to a non-compete agreement.
Oh, that's right. He agreed not to poach State Farm's clients or start his own competing insurance business.
Yeah, for 1 year after he retired. And in tax law, payments you get for agreeing not to do something are generally considered ordinary income.
I see. It's like they're saying, we're paying you to sit on the sidelines for a year. That's essentially a form of compensation, right?
Right. The court even referenced a previous case, Commissioner V. Danielson, that supports this idea. Payments for covenants not to compete are basically seen as a substitute for the regular income you'd be making if you were working.
Makes sense. So big lesson here, folks. If you're an independent contractor, get your ownership rights spelled out clearly in your contracts. If you don't own the assets, you can't claim capital gains on them.
And if you're getting paid not to compete, be prepared to pay taxes on that money as ordinary income. All right, let's move on to our second Baker case.
Hit me with it.
This one's about Daniel Baker, and it gets into those dependency exemption issues we mentioned earlier. It all revolves around who can claim a child as a dependent on their taxes.
Always a tricky area, especially in situations where parents aren't together anymore.
Exactly. So Daniel Baker was an unmarried parent who shared custody of his daughter with a woman named Deanna Wiss. We'll call the daughter A for privacy.
All right, makes sense. So what tax year are we talking about here?
This is all going down in 2003. And the big question was whether Daniel Baker could claim A as a dependent on his return for that year.
I'm guessing both parents tried to claim her, which is always a recipe for a tax headache.
Yep, that's exactly what happened. Both Daniel Baker and Deanna Wuss tried to claim A as a dependent on their 2003 returns. As you can imagine, that raised a red flag for the IRS.
Big time red flag. I'm sure those folks at the IRS see that kind of thing all the time. So what evidence did the IRS use to challenge Daniel Baker's claim?
Well, a few things pointed to Deanna Wuss being the custodial parent, at least as far as the state was concerned.
So there were official records that kind of tipped the scales in her favor.
Right. Delaware state records actually listed Wuss as the custodial parent. Plus, she was receiving public assistance for A, and A's health insurance was through Medicaid, not through anything connected to Baker.
Okay, so on paper, it's looking like Wes was the one primarily responsible for A.
Right. So now the pressure's on Daniel Baker to prove otherwise.
What did he offer as evidence to support his claim?
His main evidence was his own testimony. He said he was providing more than half of his daughter's support and that A lives with him for more than half of 2003.
Sounds a bit flimsy, especially when going up against official state records and the like.
Exactly. And the court was not convinced at all.
Did he have any documentation to back up his claims? You know, receipts, bank statements, anything like that?
Not really. And that was a big problem. The court was pretty harsh in their assessment of his testimony.
Oh, I bet. How'd they put it?
They said it was conclusory, vague, self-serving, and uncorroborated. Ouch.
Wow, they didn't hold back. So basically, they're saying they don't find his testimony credible or reliable.
Exactly. They also didn't put much weight on the testimony of Baker's mother and a friend who occasionally babysat A.
I guess the court figured they were just trying to help him out, not exactly unbiased witnesses.
That's how the court saw it. They said their testimony wasn't based on personal knowledge and was also self-serving, basically just repeating what Baker was claiming without any independent proof.
That's a tough break for Baker. So the key takeaway here is that when you're making tax claims, especially those related to dependents, you need more than just your word. You need solid evidence to back it up.
Absolutely. Think receipts, canceled checks, bank statements, school records, custody agreements, any kind of official documentation that can support your claim. The IRS wants to see proof, not just stories.
And the courts are going to hold you to a high standard of proof.
Right. The court specifically mentioned that taxpayers have the burden of proof when it comes to claiming tax benefits.
Makes sense. You're the one asking for the break, so you need to prove you deserve it.
And in this case, Baker just couldn't meet that burden of proof. The evidence he presented wasn't enough to overcome the information the IRS had gathered.
And I'm guessing the specific requirements in the tax code for claiming a dependent also played a role in the court's decision.
They sure did. The court actually cited the relevant sections of the Internal Revenue Code, sections 151 and 152, which lay out the rules for who qualifies as a dependent, section 2, which deals with head of household filing status, and sections 24 and 32, which cover the child tax credit and earned income tax credit.
So because Baker couldn't prove he met the requirements for claiming A as a dependent, he couldn't take advantage of those other tax breaks either.
Exactly. It's all connected. So if you're out there listening and you're claiming someone as a dependent or hoping to claim head of household status or any of those child-related tax credits, make sure you have the documentation to back it up. Don't just assume it'll be fine.
Word to the wise. All right, so we've got these two Baker cases, both dealing with tax disputes. One's about business income, the other's about dependency exemptions. What's the common thread here? What can we learn from both of their losses?
Well, on the surface, they seem like different issues, but I think there's a pretty clear connection.
What is it? I'm all ears.
It's about the importance of documentation and understanding how the IRS operates. Both cases highlight how the IRS scrutinizes taxpayer claims and relies on concrete evidence to make their decisions.
Right. In both cases, the IRS was looking for proof, not just assertions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In Warren Baker's case, they dove into the contract to determine who actually owned the assets. In Daniel Baker's case, they wanted documentation to support his claims about supporting and housing his daughter.
So it's not enough to just have a general idea of how things work or to assume that what you believe to be true is enough. You need to have the paperwork to back it up.
Precisely. And that's a lesson that applies to so many areas of tax law. When it comes to your business income, know the rules for classifying different types of income. If you're selling assets, understand what constitutes ownership. And if you're claiming dependents or any other tax benefits, document everything. receipts, agreements, records, whatever it takes to prove your case.
Great advice. And it all comes down to being proactive. Don't wait until you're facing an audit to start thinking about these things. Get organized, understand the rules, and keep good records. It'll save you a lot of headaches down the road.
Exactly. And one last thing to think about. These Baker cases show how specific details and legal agreements can have huge tax implications. It makes you wonder what other areas of your financial life might have similar hidden complexities. Are there any areas where you might be making assumptions about the tax rules without fully understanding the details? Maybe it's time to review those contracts, do some research, and talk to a tax professional to make sure you're on solid ground.
That's a great point to end on. Thanks for taking us on this deep dive into the world of tax court. Always fascinating to see how these cases play out and what we can learn from them.
Thanks for joining us today in the Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.